This month at PostWrestlingCafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. PostWrestlingCafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.
Here's a sample of a free podcast from the Post Wrestling Cafe. $6 gets you through the door at PostWrestlingCafe.com.
You are on a collision course.
And good evening. It is Saturday, December 6th. I am Kate from Montreal. This is Collision Course. I am joined once again this week. First time, I think we've had the same co-host 2 weeks in a row. Thank you so much, waiting for joining me this week.
What an honor. And,
you have broken a barrier here, but always happy to have you on, and thank you for dedicating your Saturday night to us.
You know, during Continental Classic season, you don't really have to pull my leg too hard. These have been two very good shows that I've been able to talk about. So
I would say, I mean, we'll probably talk about it later. I think I actually preferred Collision this week. But we'll get into it, the reasons for that. And we start out tonight with the coldest of cold opens. Like, I don't know for your feet. I was watching on like
Trailer.
Linear cable. No, I was watching on USA Network. And it came in like you were already two bars into Where Is My Mind when the feed started. So like, oh, okay. Like, hey, here we go. As Orange Cassidy makes his way to the ring to take on Roderick Strong, his not really but kind of stable mate. Both are on 0 points in the Continental Classic. This is a Blue League match, having lost to Claudio and Konosuke Takeshita, respectively. We get a voiceover update from Renee Paquette that Cassidy sustained an injury last week but has been cleared to participate, which, yeah, he's in the ring. We figured that out. Of course, when she was saying update, I think all of us went to like, oh yeah, we were supposed to be hearing something about Darby. They mentioned this on Wednesday and then haven't mentioned it in any of the other promotion for the show, but more on that later. This starts with a very kind of technical opening, a series of chops by Roderick into that is then turned into a chokehold by Cassidy. Interestingly enough, some dueling chants off. You would think that Cassidy would be the clear audience favorite, and that did happen more as the match went along, but they liked both of them at the beginning of this Columbus, Ohio crowd. Cassidy is able to he gets this chokehold on and he keeps it on for a long time. Like, Roderick cannot shake this off until he finally is able to hit him with this huge chop. Cassidy rolls to the outside. Strong follows, chops him all around the outside of the ring, hits a backbreaker on the guardrail, and then moves back inside the ring. He's targeting Cassidy's injured back, which he said he was going to do. He hits a series of 9 backbreakers until Cassidy's finally able to get his hands into the pockets and turn the advantage in his favor. He hits a suicide dive to the outside, bounces Strong's head off the turnbuckles. He goes for the elbow drop, which Strong turns into a power slam, and Cassidy sort of falls into a crucifix pin attempt, then hits a DDT from the outside that allows him just a few moments to recover, climbs the ropes as Strong punches him and tries to set up for a backbreaker, but Cassidy fights free, gets out and hits a tornado DDT that gets him a two count, a backbreaker, and the end of heartache from Strong for two, a quick roll up Cassidy gets another two. A backbreaker attempt is then turned into the Stun Dog Millionaire. Cassidy dodges another end of heartache attempt and ties Strong up for the win. He gets his first 3 points. Strong falls to 0-2.
I thought an excellent match. I love them working the long headlocks at the beginning, ramping up with the chops, and then, you know, just giving us like a really classic showcase of Strong's backbreakers all through to Cassidy's great end of heartache counters. Everything these two, you know, were able to do looked technically perfect. It was well-paced, well-designed match that I think completely lives up to the high standard you would expect out of the Continental Classic. So, you know, to start off, I think a very satisfying match that already sets the tone really well for this being, I think, a pretty, you know, strong addition of the show.
Yeah, I think that the Continental Classic, you get, I think a lot of the strength of it comes from what happens in the matches that, you know, are between a couple of guys who you know are not winning. And this was, I think, the first example of this that we've had. Like, your abs, like, there, no one has Strong or Cassidy as you're the guy who's coming out of this on top. But yeah, I thought they put on a very entertaining match, kind of played to their strengths. It also sort of continued to build that story a bit, where, like, is or is Strong not a friend to Cassidy at the end? He walks away without acknowledging him, even though Cassidy seems to kind of want to kind of shake hands and make nice. We'll see where they're going with that. I'm never quite sure how much that story is working, but they at least, like, they tied it in here. So we'll see where it goes now.
I think it's cute. I mean, you know,
it is cute. Like, I think, yeah. I like it more than I used to, is what I'll say. Mm-hmm. It grated on my nerves at first. They have seemed to find a way to make it work. As far as what I was saying earlier, we then get the announcement that Darby Allin is out of the C2 and will be replaced by Jack Perry, who, as they note, has been on a hot streak since he came back. They go to Darby, who is standing out what looks like outside the venue, which would technically mean that he came all the way to Columbus, Ohio to stand on a balcony and shout at a camera and do nothing else because he's injured. Okay, sure.
Could be that. Like, I don't know. He might have come to get checked by the doctors, which is when they might have told him the news.
Yeah. Absolutely. Sure. Let's go with that. Yep. That's this hasn't been a banner week for AEW explaining things, but yeah, we'll go with that. They cut to Darby, and he says that the Death Riders are winning their war. He says that during his match against Kevin Knight, he felt his legs give out and he was taken to the hospital. The doctor ruled him out. He's very clear about the fact that this is not his choice. He's being told that he cannot participate. He doesn't like Perry, but he says, you know what, go win the whole fucking thing. And says, and as for Darby, he just kind of breaks down, walks away. Bit of an interesting promo here, I thought, from him, just the building frustration.
I thought it was a very good, like, realistic emotional reaction from somebody who was, you know, is basically benched because of an injury. I mean, it felt like he was able to really channel his probably real frustrations into this promo. And, you know, it's a huge loss to the tournament, of course. He's just one of the most spectacular performers, not just in the company, but really in pro wrestling. But for my curiosity, I thought it was kind of neat to see what they would do in this sort of situation by, you know, like having an alternate, having a substitute come in here. Mm-hmm. It's still early enough that I mean, it doesn't really, I think, hurt the sanctity of the tournament so far.
Refresh my memory. I think Commander came in to last year's as an injury replacement for someone. And I can't, it was either Commander or Mortos. Like, they have had a situation where they had to replace someone last minute before. I just don't remember if it was after the tournament started. This is one thing that differentiates
Juice,
it from
right.
it was Juice. Yeah, okay, it was Juice Robinson. Mm-hmm. this is one thing that differentiates it from the G1, of course, is because you're doing TV. You can't just sacrifice all of the time that you had set aside for those matches. So if someone goes out, someone is coming in. And yeah, I think Perry makes a good choice. My only concern about him is that I think Darby was going to be there. He wasn't going to get a lot of wins. He was there more to serve as kind of a beloved character, but who's going to end up putting a lot of people over. Perry is not in as strong a position, so I worry that he's going to be hurt if they have those, because like, they can't really change the results, because the math on this kind of the thing is incredibly delicate. But we'll see. I think that, yeah, like using him, although he's clearly got another story going, is a good idea. You see him getting any wins?
Sure, I do. Yeah, I think it's a great chance for him to showcase what maybe a babyface version of this, like, sort of like pseudo scapegoat or post scapegoat, I should say, you know, a version of himself might be. I think in ring he's looked really good in these tag team matches so far. So yeah. I'm curious to see when he's in there with like some of the best talent in the entire company in these sort of singles matches, like what he's able to show. I'm hoping that he's able to impress. You know, he's at a level right now where I wouldn't put him in the class with really the field, you know, as far as like, you know, being recognized as like among the best in-ring performers of the company, but that could always change. And this is the tournament to prove that.
So I think big opportunity for him. Sucks for Darby. Yeah, I really like this program. You're going to be hearing those words from me a bit tonight, but I thought that this was a very intriguing character bit from Darby. Like, I'm very curious to see what happens next. So, hopefully, like, for Darby, not over too long.
He wins the war against Moxley, beats the Death Riders, but somehow comes out of it even worse off.
Yeah.
And I'm very curious to see where he takes the character now. I mean, I imagine this is not the type of injury that'll take him out for so long, seeing as how
this seemed more
like he's going for surgery or anything like that.
So, no, this seemed more like the kind of injury he's putting it like he stopped feeling his legs, but like he was taken to the hospital, he was released. I think that if he was going to have surgery, we'd know about it. Like they just would have said that. So yeah, kind of it's a bummer for him, but it at least doesn't seem to be something that's going to keep him out for ages. And yeah, they've put out this little teaser that makes me genuinely interested to see what might be next, because I feel like it might be unpredictable. More spoken segment. FDR come out. We get a recap of the confrontation from last week with the Bang 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 Gang, and almost thought that we were watching the exact same thing again, because once again, Stokely starts off by saying that tonight is the greatest night of his life, which is exactly how he started last week, saying that it was the greatest night of his life because FTR are tag team champions. That said, he's pissed off. He said, no more fun and games. They want the Bang Bang Gang in the ring right now. And Juice Robinson and Austin Gunn are more than happy to oblige. I will say it took me a moment to recover from Juice's hair here. I can only describe this as turbo mullet. It was something else. But he's always fascinating to watch. Cash tells them as soon as they're out that the last time that they beat the FTR is the last time they will beat FTR. Said their biggest accomplishments will always be being Billy's boy and Mr. Tony Storm, which is the first time they have acknowledged this, and kind of weird given what they're doing with the women's tag teams.
He actually said it on Wednesday.
Oh, he did. I guess. Okay. Yeah. It's odd, but yeah, I think that most people do know that Juice Robinson is married to Tony Storm, and
does the character of Timeless Tony Storm know that she's married? You know, because from her exploits, we assume that she's looking for Wendy Richter and having a lot of extramarital affairs.
Yeah, exactly. I am quite sure there. I'm definitely, I've said this before, I'm definitely down for a reality show with these two, because I think it would be like, I want to know what they're like at home. Like, they could just be the most boring people in the world, and that would still actually be kind of interesting.
Toni Storm, though, is such a great character. Like, it's at the point now where I don't really want that illusion broken with me. Like, I kind of don't want to see her in her real life form anymore. Like, I'd rather, yeah. I hope she's in character the whole time.
No. Yeah, well, it does seem likely. Certainly no one is better at guarding their character. Mm. And Dax adds to this that the only time the Bang Bang Gang are relevant is when they are standing across from us. Us in this case, meaning FTR, not Wei and I. Nobody comes close to FTR. There's no way they can ever beat them. And you and Dax is like, you know, you touch my belt before, go ahead, touch my belt. I double dare you. Austin Gunn grabs Mike and he's like, the crowd is of course chanting, touch the belt. Austin's like, no, let them have their moment. And he says, I am the son of a Hall of Famer. Juice is the son of a carpenter. Cash is the son of his cousin. And Dax is just a son of a bitch. And Juice adds, he's like, if we wanted to, like, they don't need to touch their belts. If they wanted to get belts, they could. They won $200,000. They could just go on shopaew.com and buy hundreds of belts to take home. He said he doesn't need. He says he has a belt holding up his pants. He doesn't need another belt. He needs a title. And if you're not down with that, we got two words for you, crowd. Guns up. Juice pauses. Says, and new.
Yeah. I thought it was a very good segment, honestly. I think there are some great lines to start, you know. I was a little bit disappointed by FTR because we pretty much had exactly the same bullet points and insults from their pre-tape promo on Wednesday. Nepo Baby, yeah. Mr. Toni Storm. So, yes. I certainly maybe was a little bit disappointed in them, but I mean, I also don't really get the sense that they were supposed to be the focus of this. If anything, I would have expected Juice to be the focus of it, but I came out of it feeling like Austin Gunn really stole the show here. I thought he had some of the best lines to start. I'm the son of a Hall of Famer. You're just, you know, the son of your cousin or your son of a bitch.
Or a son of a bitch, yeah.
Great charismatic delivery. And if I have to really kind of like put him on some sort of comparison point, I almost kind of feel like he's very close to maybe the level that his dad was, which, I mean, is, you know, his dad was always an okay promo, but I mean, always played second fiddle, of course, to Road Dogg, in their tag team. So I think, I mean, it says a lot about maybe the growth of Austin Gunn and the comfort of Austin Gunn, especially in this babyface role. So I thought overall, like, a really strong talking segment here from Bang Bang Gang.
Yeah, I thought when I heard that they were doing this, my thought was, well, we literally just did this last week. And when they started, I'm like, we literally just did this last week. But yeah, I think the strength here was with Juice and particular with Austin, as you said, he killed this. And I think played off the audience really well. Like, so they're like, oh, let them have their moment. And like he was very conscious of the crowd and knew how to play to them without letting them take over the segment, which is a skill. And the thing that I think is like, okay, I'm now actually quite invested. I want these guys to get those titles, which they will not, because I think that the end game with FTR is clearly to when Cope and Christian come back to revisit that. But with the titles on the line, I never thought the titles needed to be on the line for that rivalry. I think it works on its own. So
it could still be the case. They could be playing with our expectations. You know, we don't know.
I would be happy if that were the case, because this felt like a really fresh take for the tag division. And I think the start to getting people engaged in your tag division again is giving them teams to be excited about. And they did that to a certain extent with Brodito.
Yep.
And that's getting transferred onto the guns. So I think you're kind of picking up the pieces in this division and it's working, but this really made me think I would like to see them.
It's such a testament to, I think, the talent that is in the Bang Bang Gang. The fact that like they can lose one member, they can lose two members, but yet they could still drum up interest by whomever is left. In fact, like, I think they're using it to their advantage, because would we be talking about Austin Gunn this much if Jay White was still in the group? I'm not so sure about that. So yeah, like they're surviving.
Or would we even be that interested in seeing Austin and Juice in this match if Jay White was there and he was more the focus? So
it'd be very different.
No, and they absolutely deserved it. So yeah, I think the Bang Bang Gang did really well here. We go backstage where Marina Shafir is giving a pep talk to the new Death Riders tag team, Wheeler Yuta and Daniel Garcia. Of course, they're not talking tag team stuff right now. Garcia said that Mark Briscoe is, well, Marina first of all points out, like, hey, Mark Briscoe, you don't have anyone to give you these sorts of pep talks, which, I don't know, she's pretty scary. Maybe he doesn't want to have someone who gives him those sorts of pep talks. Garcia says that he always knew Briscoe was stupid, but the stupidest thing he has ever done was to put the TNT title up against him, which is happening next week on Winter is Coming Collision Edition.
Yeah, they're making this Cardiff show next Saturday feel like a pretty big one. You know, by announcing a whole lot in advance and at least making it feel like an elevated version of the show, which they really should.
Yeah, this is, it's interesting because they have done these sorts of weird, like, dual shows where it's like a Dynamite and a Collision on the same theme. Mm-hmm. This is like they have, like, they're split up not just in terms of filming, continents? But like in terms, yeah, like they're on different continents. Like they, it's odd that they would choose two shows that are filming completely separately, different cities, like different, like you said, different continents. And yet they're choosing to present it as kind of a thing. Both of these shows read like, they've done this before, but sort of miniature pay-per-views. Like it's sort of a, it's not, obviously you're still going to have ads. It's still going to be a 2-hour time, but this feels like the kind of thing, if they wanted to do it afterwards, they could sort of edit both shows together without the ads. It's like, here's a pay-per-view. Because they it's basically what it is.
In this case, it would just be a really strange, maybe, shift halfway through. Like,
exactly.
All of a sudden, we're like across the ocean.
Edit them out of order and like just sort of like, no. It's just a different angle on the crowd who are completely different people.
It just seems to be their way of like labeling something to maybe hopefully drive a bit more interest to the show and give them an excuse to book something a bit bigger than usual, which I'm all for.
Yeah.
The holiday season is fast approaching, but if you still have a few people left on your shopping list, don't worry. Uncommon Goods takes the hassle out of holiday gifting with thousands of unique, one-of-a-kind presents you won't find anywhere else. Many of these gifts are high-quality, handmade, or crafted by independent artists and small makers. One standout gift this season is the personalized Pet Family Blanket, an exclusive item created by artist Shelley Klein and available only at Uncommon Goods. Shelley creates custom portraits in her sweetly simple illustration style, where you can customize skin tones, hair, clothing colors, and pet details to make it truly personal. Measuring 50 by 60 inches, made from soft cotton and polyester, it's perfect for snuggling with your furry family. Plus, each purchase supports small makers and donates $1 to a nonprofit of your choice, including the International Rescue Committee and American Forests. So don't wait. Make this holiday the year you give something truly unforgettable. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/postwrestling. That's uncommongoods.com/postwrestling for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary.
December on the Post Wrestling Cafe, we have two editions of Rewind Away set for you, including a patron's pick where you have voted for us to review the Survivor Series from 1991, Hulk Hogan's Gravest Challenge. Then it's over to 2002 and a review of the very first WWE draft involving Raw and SmackDown as they kick off the brand extension. David Bitsenspan is going to join me as we review Video Killed the Radio Star, a documentary on Bubba the Love Sponge, and the sex tape involving Hulk Hogan. Plus, we will have reviews of TNA Final Resolution, New Japan's World Tag League Final, Collision Course every single week, and XL editions of Rewind to Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown. Sign up now at postwrestlingcafe.com.
Our next match, another Blue League match for the Continental Classic. Claudio Castagnoli versus Mascara Dorada. CMLL World Champion Claudio Castagnoli versus CMLL Welterweight Champion Mascara Dorada.
So I need to mention this on behalf of a lot of people that were watching on Twitter. The stream totally messed up for this particular match. And did it for you as well?
Nope. Totally fine. But I did see the comments online. My guess is that that means that this match will be popping up on YouTube in the near future. There were apparently problems with the free feed, the YouTube feed for the pre-show of Final Battle last night, which I think I commented this on Blue Sky. Like, the best advertisement for Honor Club last night to me was the fact that I was looking at all these people complaining, going, "What are you talking about? Like, when?" Like,
it's funny,
I haven't had any issues because the Honor Club feed was like, it's the other
way around. The last time it was the reverse.
Yes.
So they fixed Honor Club, but now they broke YouTube somehow.
Yeah, that's just okay. This is everything. Everything is cursed.
Just subscribe to the both of them. As long as you have the both of them, one of them will work out.
Yeah. Well, and hey, I got, I guess, I had an okay time with the Honor Club last night. That happened one other time where, like, I was fine with the ROHP, but they had problems with it before. This just does not seem to be AEW's year in terms of in terms of the platforms on which their shows air. I did get my money back for the from the Amazon debacle, though.
Nice. So tell me about this match. I'm really sad I missed it. This was one of the ones I was looking for.
Yeah, this is
the most.
Okay. Yeah, and oh no, you didn't miss anything. It was nothing really. It's fine. Crowd is very into Dorada from the beginning. He just starts off, he knew what he was getting himself into. His whole the opening to this match for him is just, I am going to avoid letting this man touch me. Like, that is, I just cannot let Claudio get any kind of a grip or any kind of move. So he's like dodging out of the way until Claudio is able to land a kick and a big chop. And that shifts the balance of power. But Dorada recovers enough. He hits a double springboard arm drag Claudio down. Then Claudio recovers. He just levels him with an uppercut as Dorada tries to hit a tope. Nigel sort of say, like, okay, Claudio, like, just drops Dorada onto the guardrail super hard, at which point Nigel pipes up and says, "I'd love to see another shot of that." And as if Claudio had Nigel in his ear, picks Garada up, does the exact same thing again. As we go to add, we come back, and things are very much the same. Claudio hits the giant swing. There's a running European uppercut dodges the second attempt. Once he kicks Claudio, takes them both down. Another arm drag takedown of Claudio's shoulders and Hurricane Rana. Claudio blocks a tope from Dorada, but he gets very full of himself. He cheers and misses the fact that Dorada's gone right back into the ring, reset, and comes right back out at him. And this does take him down. It's not even that he takes him down with the force of the tope, though. Like, he hooks his arm on the way and so turns it into, like, this flying arm drag, which seems to be one of Dorada's kind of big signature moves. Speaking of which, he is a cartwheel arm drag off the top turnbuckle to the outside. It's a destroyer, and that gets a two count. A crossbody attempt, though, is turned into a backbreaker by Claudio. He hits a running uppercut and a snapmare for another two count. Dorada almost sort of wraps him up, and then hits a thrust kick, but then is taken down by a big lariat. Claudio catches Dorada off a crossbody attempt. He climbs to the top, but Dorada escapes to the kamigiri and hits a super poison Rana, where Dorada lands on his feet, which is like, I don't know, like, the move is complicated enough to come out of it so that you're on your feet is just exceptional. Claudio recovers, but gets thrown down again. It's a shooting star press from Dorada, who gets the three count and pins Claudio Castagnoli to stop his run at 6 points in the Continental Classic. For those of you who might have wondered, as I did, does this mean that Dorada gets a shot at Claudio's title? It does not, because CMLL operates with weight classes, and Dorada is fully 70 pounds too light to qualify to take Claudio on. It's funny because going into this match, I actually thought Dorada might take it specifically because I thought it might set up this this match. But no, I am incorrect. That is not how CMLL works. So it's just a chance for one of their champions and a young star to get a win over on the big guy.
It's fascinating. Well, for a number of reasons. I mean, Claudio just had that big win over Moxley. And no, I wouldn't expect Claudio to go on like a winning streak for the rest of the tournament. But still, coming so soon after the Moxley match, having him lose and is like, what, 3 nights later to Mascara Dorada, I thought was fascinating. Secondly, I have to imagine CMLL was okay with this booking. And I guess, you know, does it tell you something about maybe how much they think, well, it's their guy beating an AEW guy, so yes, I get it. But of course, they'd be okay with that. But it's also like giving people the impression that your heavyweights aren't necessarily beating everybody underneath their weight class, and anybody can beat anybody depending on, the style matchup, perhaps.
I do think that given how Dorada is presented as one of CMLL's biggest rising stars, that there is a bit of that in here, that he is so good he can even beat the heavyweights. And so yeah, this sort of subtly boosts CMLL's booking as well. Yeah, I think Claudio did a very good job here of sort of playing the very arrogant heel. And as I said, there was at least one point where he was literally just sort of posing for the crowd, like, haha, I like blocked him from hitting this tope, and completely missing the fact that he had recovered. So it wasn't explicit, but there was this sort of sense that you got that Claudio had gotten a bit full of himself, and that Dorada was just able to figure out a way to unlock him. Like, it wasn't a pummeling or anything, but he chose his spots well. And that was a very, very enjoyable match. I think picture what you would, what you think you're getting from a match with Claudio Castagnoli fighting Mascara Dorada, and that is pretty much what it was. So super solid, very entertaining, and yeah, like the nice sort of surprise at the end. I don't think Dorada is going, like, again, he's not going to go on a huge winning streak himself or anything, but I never thought that he was going to go, like, that he was going to do a goose egg. You knew he was going to get like a couple solid wins in here, and this is certainly one of them. Yeah. Tony Schiavone is doing an interview with the two finalists for the Women's Tag Team Championship belts. And he just says straight up that he's conflicted. He thinks a lot of the fans are going to be conflicted. He's conflicted himself because, you know, people love both of these teams, which Tony Storm introduces four bitches with the itches who fight to rule the britches.
Wow.
She has a way. Yes. There is... She says that, she and Mina have the advantage because they didn't just become a tag team. They live being a tag team. Might be news to your husband, Tony, but okay, whatever. You know, that's like, I'm not shaming. Willow recalls that she and Harley actually had a match on Dark quite a while ago. And since then, they have both been through a lot and sort of risen and kept smiling, kept their positivity to get to the point where they are going into this final. She's not worried at all about the fact that they are not a long-standing team. Harley points out that her first 3 years as a professional wrestler, she has been more successful than either Tony or Mina were in their first few years. Not actually untrue, although, you know, there's clearly a caveat. So she's, without being arrogant, she's pretty confident. At the end, Mina just said, like, as things are starting to get tense, Mina just says that she, you know, they should just be concentrating on giving everyone a great fight. And Tony Schiavone's like, yeah, okay, I can drink to that. And this is the end of the segment. Interesting choice, I would say, having the two babyface teams against each other.
Yes, definitely.
I don't think the crowd is going to have too much trouble cheering for both of them, but it'll be interesting.
I mean, I personally like it a lot. I like this segment a lot. You know, I thought all four of them got to show a little bit of personality, and in a short amount of time, they managed to build a good amount of tension, despite all of them being baby faces. Got into a little bit of their history with each other. Tony beat them each one-on-one. Harley, mm-hmm. I think, actually had a great retort by, you know, like... telling us like a factual statement that like her first 3 years are
arguably more successful. Yeah.
Yeah. Her first 3 years are arguably way more successful than anybody else's first three years sitting on this particular panel. So not a long segment, but I thought they all managed to show a good amount of personality. And I think I can understand why Tony Khan went with Babes of Wrath here. I mean, their personality and likability are very high. And if you're looking to give a team some sort of value to come out of this tournament with, I can actually see them winning the championships over Toni Storm and Mina Shirakawa if you want to make a new team, you know, and use two new characters.
I think that, definitely. I can see this going either way. I think that unless you have some sort of immediate plan for either Willow or Harley, it makes sense to put the titles on them just because they're two people you want on TV. Tony and Mina don't need titles. My concern with the belts, though, is unless you are increasing the number of matches that you have on a show, you're already sort of... cutting it, like, you know, limiting the time that you're giving to your two singles belts, and because everything has been focused on the tag tournament.
Yeah.
We'll see. I just you need to find a way to keep all of your stars present on television to keep them from cooling off, and that is all I will say on that. Speaking of stars getting back on TV, Swerve Strickland comes out to address the crowd. He says that 2 weeks ago he returned, having been on the shelf for 3 months. He's the biggest, baddest, most dangerous version of Swerve they've ever seen, and his only purpose in coming back was to get to the AEW World Championship. He reminds us, of course, that he's the one who took the title off Joe the first time, and he says that since he got back, Joe has been running from him, but it doesn't matter. He says that he and Hangman might be AEW's greatest rivalry. I think a lot of people would agree with him on that. And he offers to be, I thought this was already settled, but whatever, I'm not going to nitpick. He offers to be Hangman's partner for one night and one night only.
I mean, they had matching gear. Like, they both, like, you know, like, came out with chains. You know, what more do you need to signal that these two have already, you know, made this sort of agreement long ago?
Buried the hatchet, not in each other.
Not yet.
No. We shall see where this is going. The sort of darker presentation of Swerve is it's intriguing to me. Like, I want to see, like, there is definitely an edge to his character that is different than it was where, like, he's still Swerve, but he feels kind of different this time.
You mean like since he's come back?
Yes. I guess with the new music and everything, like, we'll see.
I just think he's walking now with even more sort of presence and just, you know, I'm trying not to use the word aura because it's so overused now, but
yeah, I know, it's like
thing. He does the slow
this is
walk
the thing,
now.
Like, if you're talking about wrestling, like, aura is often really appropriate.
Yeah,
but you're right, it's just so overused. And it's
he's like
okay.
He's trying to do a Roman Reigns, you know, type of like you know, energy upon walkout, and I have to say it's been very effective. Like, he's felt like such a main character since he has for a long time, but especially since coming back, he's felt like just a big deal coming out and just seeing him. So I
he does like he's bigger than he was, but it's also like feel like the presence feels heavier. Like,
And I thought he sounded great here, as always.
Yeah. He is interrupted, did not see this one coming, by Josh Alexander. And Josh says, this is Don Callis's house now. And it's also like I'm looking at this going, like, do they have beef? Do they, like, okay, no, Dave, put it out of your mind, because he reminds him that Don Callis, the Don Callis family were the ones who took him out. He's not surprised that Swerve isn't looking for revenge, because he wouldn't either in his position, but he is angry that Swerve thinks he can come back and get a title shot. He recounts his own accomplishments, beating Ospreay, killing Kota Ibushi, taking Kenny Omega out, and he proposes that the two of them he says, I deserve a title shot, so the two of them should have a number one contenders match next week on Collision. And as he wraps this up, Swerve is like, sure, let's do this. And he's like challenging them to come to the ring, at which point Katsuyori Shibata shows up, takes out Swerve's injured leg from behind, and just dips. I did not see this coming. I thought Alexander was really good here. Like, I was, I think we've even spoken before about how the couple of times they've allowed him to talk, he's been better than what I remember him being in TNA. Maybe it's just because I like him better as a heel. But yeah, I thought that this went from why this guy to, okay, this is really cool. This is actually, you know, the man makes some points in a hurry.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the Kota Ibushi injury was terrible, but I have been really glad that they've been able to use it to like help escalate Josh Alexander into feeling like a bigger star. And I wonder if, like, even without that injury, if Tony Khan had these plans, or if maybe understanding that, hey, this is an opportunity to like push a guy coming out of a terrible incident, that he decided to do that through the Kenny Omega feud and just, like this now. So, but he's stepped up. I mean, he's one of those guys who I think has been desperate for this sort of airtime, this sort of spotlight. He's got it now, and I think he's just using it for all it's worth. In this particular segment, I thought he actually did a great job of showing like his improv ability by making fun of the Harley Quinn cosplayer ringside, calling
it furries.
They are at GalaxyCon, of course, which I'm sure has plenty of that sort of thing. So he, I think, has really stepped up over the past few months. We know how great he is in ring, but as a heel, like with the louder character, I think he's done really well.
He has come into his own. And I think very much like as the sort of the top dogs in the Don Callis family turn on each other, you're going to probably create an avenue for him to rise to be like the star. Like Callis, he's a slime ball. He's just going to reform however he can. And I think you're elevating Alexander to be one of the new top guys in that group. So yeah, I never thought about it, but as soon as it's on the table, like, hell yeah, I want to see Josh Alexander versus Swerve.
He's very unlikely to beat Swerve. I mean, all signs point to Swerve versus Joe as a rematch. I look for the match for us to be impressed with him.
Yeah. And we are going to get it next week on Collision. Backstage, Lexi Nair is with Mercedes Moné, who is still mid breakdown. Lexi starts to ask her about her match against Velvet last night. Mercedes does not want to talk about it. And she is just already, like, she's almost going Tony Storm here. Like, she is just clinging to her glory and sort of falling apart and talking like she is still, you know, she's still 12 belts Moné. She is still the, you know, the biggest thing in the division. And it's like the only thing, like, when Lexi asks, like, was her loss weighing on her mind? She says the only thing weighing on her is her 12 titles, which sends us out to our women's match of the night, Mercedes Moné defending her TBS title versus Layla Gray. They do a sort of quick recap of the both women's night at Final Battle. So you're sort of aware that Layla got the win while Mercedes took the loss. The match just starts, like, as the ref is holding up the belt, you just see Mercedes kind of leap on Gray from behind. So it's like kind of chaotic right from the beginning. Layla bails to the outside. Mercedes hits a baseball slide kick and then a meteora to Christopher Daniels, who, of course, is out there being the kind of mentor to all of Skyflight. Gray snaps Mercedes' neck on the ropes. It's a basement dropkick. Get the neck breaker for two. An enziguri from Layla. Mercedes pushes her face first into the turnbuckle and hit the Meteora for two as we go to add. Come back to Layla hitting a running bulldog, which Mercedes reverses into the statement maker for the win. Kind of an abrupt ending. Looked like maybe Layla got hurt during the match. I hope not. That would be that would be kind of sad. Just to quickly, just to go over what happened after the match. Mercedes refuses to let go of the hold after the match is called. Christopher Daniels interferes to pull her off, and Mercedes kicks him low, which gets a huge reaction from the crowd. She gets out of the ring. She grabs Tony Schiavone's headset, and she reminds everyone that she is the greatest TBS champion of all time.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly hope she's not injured. I personally thought maybe it was just probably booked to be like this, you know, not necessarily a match to evoke so much drama, but maybe more so just...
It was how quickly it ended coming back from ad that kind of threw me. Like,
We wait to see. It's possible.
Yeah.
But I felt like the purpose of this match was to rehab Monet, and not only that, but to, you know, show that she's got an even meaner streak than before, that maybe last night was her kind of like being a little bit too complacent, and now she's coming back and she's even meaner than she was prior. So I thought that was relatively effective here in a short amount of time. She is now holding on to, like, I'm still the greatest TBS champion of all time moniker, trying to build that up. And maybe as a sort of some sort of like new... I want to say consolation now that maybe the peak of her, you know, multi-belt run might be coming to an end.
Yeah. Now, Mercedes is due to defend her RevPro Women's Championship next week against Rio, not AEW Rio, but RHIO, who is a British wrestler. I think there's a decent chance she loses the belt there. Rio is definitely, like, she is a name. She's not just sort of a, she's not like sort of a random competitor for this belt. Like, this is, I think she could be down another belt by next week. And I'd say Mercedes belts kind of fall into a couple of tiers, which are the ones that are just very, like, smaller indie belts, and those that are a little bit higher profile. The RevPro one is a higher profile one. I actually would say, like, the ROH one, just because of its affiliation with AEW, was a more major one. CMLL is one of the big ones. We already talked about, like, what's probably going to happen there. But yeah, I would say that there is a good chance that Rio takes the RevPro belt off her.
I would say so too. Now, is there as good of a chance that she drops each one of these individual belts? I'm still very skeptical about some of these, but I think certainly the bigger ones, I can see her. Yeah,
I think that the big ones would be the ROH already done, RevPro, CMLL, and of course the TBS Championship, and those are all leaving in matches. We'll see what happens. Like, she could do appearances. She could lose through disqualifications. She could lose through shenanigans. Like, she could like, there's a number of ways, like, without just having her hand back the belt, that you could get something. Particularly if some of these indie companies have someone they want to build up, we'll see. Yeah.
And pushing herself as the greatest TBS champion of all time, like, continues to retain that value for her as long as she's holding this TBS championship.
Yeah.
She's still recognized and still has some level of credibility. But I would love to see her, like, evolve into a more sort of, like, evil version of herself in each of those losses, you know?
Yeah, this was very much, like, the kick to Daniels was very, like, this was a much more serious heel move than we've seen from her. So you're, at the one hand, you're right, you're getting, she's starting to kind of come apart because she's sensing her own vulnerability. And at the same time, she's getting meaner. Like, there is this streak coming out. And who takes the TBS title from her?
Good question. There are a lot of people in that mid tier that really benefit from getting that. But I'm trying to think in my mind who might be, like, a big enough name at this point that I think, or at least like, you know, is really like would really, really benefit from it. Off the top of my head, maybe like Willow seems to be tied up in the women's tag team division. Who would you say?
I mean, I think Athena is always a possibility. When Jamie Hayter came back from injury originally, she was the one I wanted to see take the title off Mercedes. That was before the whole belt collector thing really took off. And so I still kind of think that Jamie would benefit from this. They had one very good match, which Mercedes won. So Jamie kind of wanting to get her lick back is, it is like a decent story that they could go with. We'll see. But yeah, like, so I'm going to say Jamie.
We might be a long ways away from it, honestly. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, you would think a baby.
It feels like the TBS one has to be the last one to go.
Yeah, yeah. She's likely to lose it to another baby face. But I also, you know, like, who knows who might catch fire in that time?
Yeah.
Like, you know, we could be talking about like an Anna Jay, for instance, that like might all of a sudden be so, I guess, gain so much momentum that maybe people will be clamoring for her. Could be like a Queen Aminata, somebody that is not even necessarily on our radar. So we'll see.
Yeah. Like, it's with Mercedes, I think, as she loses the belts, what I was saying about how they could create that idea with Athena, that it could just be just anyone, I think they're actually setting it up to work better with that with Mercedes. Like, where as she's like losing more belts, like, yeah, all of a sudden she becomes vulnerable to literally a challenge from anyone. So you don't know necessarily when she's going to drop the belt. We can go to a backstage video with Eddie Kingston, who says, he said that Joe's trying to get in his head, but it's not going to work because Eddie's already in his own head. His problem is that he cares for professional wrestling and he cares too much for AEW. And what is happening with the young guys is wrong, because AEW is supposed to be something different. Joe was supposed to lead, but Joe is doing what he used to hate. Eddie says he has the chance to make a change. He wants to make a change and he wants to show people how to do things the right way. I have just done an incredibly quick recap. Don't listen to me. Make the time. Go watch this. This video was unreal to me. I loved this. I
thought this was great. One of the best things on the show. Last Saturday, you know, it was maybe the first great Eddie Kingston promo he's cut since he came back from injury. Yeah. Wednesday, I was kind of ultimately a bit disappointed by. I mean,
So was I. And we were talking about how last week about how it was important that they kind of set this up with a good face off between the two of them. And I was not happy with what they did on Wednesday.
But now Saturday again, clearly this guy saves his best work for the weekend.
Yeah. Mr. Saturday Night.
Oh, this was incredible. I would even in some way say it was better than last week. I mean, of course it had a bit of a different vibe in that this was pre-taped, edited with B-roll, scored. But as a result, like, I thought it felt more focused, like more to the point, you know, and the conviction in his voice still comes through, maybe even better in this sort of like close-up intimate setting. You know what I mean?
I think what's interesting is that, like, he even sort of made the one-off line last week about they told him to come out and do a shoot. And so this was, like, it came off as very off the cuff. Mm-hmm. In a way, that one almost teed this one up. Like, this one was more focused. This one was more emotional. It's like, okay, I started off talking off the top of my head, but now I'm really going to hone in on why I need to take Joe on. I think, again, I don't think anyone thinks that Eddie is winning on Wednesday.
No.
This made me want it so much, though. Yeah. Like, instead of like,
that's as much as you can expect for a challenger, right? Like, even if you know he's not going to win, like, making you want him to win. And like, that's about as much as he could do. I found this promo really interesting in that, like, he's talking about what AEW was supposed to be and how it's affecting the younger generation. And it's pretty much the exact same type of like promo that Jon Moxley has been trying to cut about the Death Riders and their, you know, reason for existing. But of course, Moxley goes about it in a much more violent and cheating way, whereas Eddie at least seems to be implying that he would rather influence the younger generation to play by the rules and play fair.
Yes.
So it just like this was the type of promo that makes me kind of like wish that, you know, if Eddie didn't get injured, I wonder if we could have had a very compelling sort of like philosophical war between Eddie Kingston and Jon Moxley during the height of like the Death Riders earlier this year.
Yeah, I like think that Professor everyone X. wanted it. Yeah, it just sucks in terms of timing because I think everyone wanted this with the Death Riders angle.
Because, like, you could just tell Eddie, like, I mean, just even probably without any sort of, like, organization or communication with Moxley, is kind of naturally sinking his teeth into that sort of storyline. And we were certainly missing the counter to the Jon Moxley argument in any of the AEW babyfaces that went up against him earlier this year. You know, you weren't getting it from Cassidy. You weren't even really getting it from Darby. You didn't even really get it from Paige, ultimately, when Paige, you know, got there. But Eddie, like, just even this promo told us that, like, hey, he has a vision for the younger generation of this company in the way that Moxley does, but just going about it a different way.
Yeah, and I feel like if you'd gotten this with Eddie, it would have forced Moxley to sort of evolve the Death Riders' Jon Moxley character beyond the kind of cartoonish villain that he was. Like, I think you're right. Like, you didn't get that response from, like, when Paige took the title off him, it wasn't like a response to Moxley's arguments. It was sort of a, this has gone on long enough, screw you, this ends now. Yep. But you never got that sort of dialogue, which I think would have benefited them greatly. But yeah, this was just on a show that had a lot of really, really good matches. This was almost my favorite thing on it. That is high praise because there was some great in-ring stuff here.
But in totality, like, what a great show, giving you like great in-ring content and also great talking segments, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And again, like, Eddie doing a great talking segment is not really a shock so much. Josh Alexander having a solid outing, Austin Gunn being so good, even Mercedes being like a more interesting version of her character. It's like, wow, you had some like a lot of interesting out of ring stuff going on here.
December on the Post Wrestling Cafe, we have two editions of Rewind Away set for you, including a patron's pick where you have voted for us to review the Survivor Series from 1991, Hulk Hogan's Gravest Challenge. Then it's over to 2002 and a review of the very first WWE draft involving Raw and SmackDown as they kick off the brand extension. David Bitsenspan is going to join me as we review Video Killed the Radio Star, a documentary on Bubba the Love Sponge, and the sex tape involving Hulk Hogan. Plus, we will have reviews of TNA Final Resolution, New Japan's World Tag League Final, Collision Course every single week, and XL editions of Rewind to Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown. Sign up now at postwrestlingcafe.com.
We go backstage where something is happening, which turns out to be Triangle of Madness, like, beating down every female wrestler in Ohio, as far as I can tell. I did, as we were going on, I was trying to sort of double check to see who all was in here, because I saw Maya World for sure, so I wanted to go back and check. And yes, she and Hyann were there in matching gear, by the way. Not really clear what their status is, but they...
I'm sure if you ask them, Kate, they'd rather remain anonymous rather than be identified as people who are so easily...
Maya, unfortunately, got her face shoved into the wall, like, right in front of the camera. It's like, oh, yeah, there you are. But there were a number of women just getting the crap beaten out of them. And as the triangle pop-up, Sky and Julia, in their perfectly spooky little cadence, say, like, sisters of sin, we come for the win. And Tekla pops up behind them and says, see you in Cardiff, bitches. And immediately I'm like, do they have anything scheduled? Like, are they doing okay? I don't, like, know. Like, they're not in the tag tournament. There's, like, okay, I don't think there's a match scheduled for them, but they're going to go over there and just, scare people.
I'm pretty sure, like, right afterwards, the graphic popped up where they announced Statlander and Hayter. will be taking on the Sisters of Satan.
Yes, sorry. Like they were, that was what was announced on Wednesday. But that's, yeah, like Tekla, I don't think has anything. But I guess she's just there to back up her girls. So yeah, like they had Statlander and Hayter challenging them. And even Hayter even said to Statlander, like afterwards, you know, you and I are going to have a chat. That was on Wednesday. Anyway, our next match is.
Ace Austin. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah.
I said Austin Gunn. I got confused.
Austin Gunn. Too many Austins. Ricochet is, I guess, fresh off his victory last night, puts his national title. I almost called it the North American title, and I got no idea where that one came from. No, this is the national title. And he's putting this on the line again against Ace Austin. This starts exactly how you would expect a match between these two to start, which is this sort of like insane sequence of takedowns and escapes. Austin almost rolls Ricochet up for the pin very quickly, which Rick just dodges out of the ring, kind of leaves to collect himself. Austin takes him down again with a kick to the back of the head and another pin attempt. And once again, Ricochet goes to the outside. He comes back, this time armed with the bell hammer. He hits Austin, who then goes to the outside himself. Ricochet hits a tope and, as he yells into the camera, landed on my damn feet. Well done. Well done, son. As we're going to add, he starts to tear up a fan sign. Just he's very much enjoying sort of getting in people's faces. Ricochet goes for a running jump into the corner, but just crashes and burns. He lands right on his neck. Austin hits a Russian leg sweep and a guillotine leg drop, his short arm clotheslines. He fights off Toa Leona on the outside and hits a crossbody and a doctor bomb for a two count. Ricochet turns this over into a quick roll up attempt. That doesn't give him the pin. So he's a standing drop kick and a shooting star press for a two count. Austin ducks the spirit gun, almost gets a quick roll up. He puts Ricochet on the turnbuckle, hits a superplex, and then what Shawnee calls a bell ringer. And I'm not sure if that is just how he described it or what the actual name of the move is. It is very cool. It's almost like, like picture a pedigree without the arm stuff. Like it's just he trapped Ricochet's sort of head between his legs and just stomped him into the ground. So bell ringer, sure, let's call it that. Cool, that's move. A good name for it. Yep. That gets a long two. Ricochet dodges the fold by pulling Mike Posey in between him and Ace. He tries to kick Ace low, but Austin catches him. He flips him over. Ricochet hits a hard short lariat, and then the package pile driver. He protects his title for the second night in a row.
Yeah, great match, I felt. I mean, Ace Austin, just spectacular, great looking, like innovative offense, you know, like for somebody in this role.
Very reminiscent of Ricochet in a way.
True. Like I was going to say, like for somebody in this role with basically no build to this match, like I think Ace Austin is the exact type of talent you would want to create something compelling purely by their in-ring performance. So I felt he did a great job. But man, Ricochet is so entertaining. Like, of course, he's great in ring, but I think now the added garnish of being able to play with the crowd so much, to act convincingly frustrated at the beginning of the match, tearing crowd signs and using them to, you know, paper cut his opponent, obnoxiously bragging about landing on his feet to the camera. Like, these are the
his ability to just find the live camera too is uncanny. Like he's so good at it because he's often like sort of able to address the crowd just by getting right up in there. And
he's that tapped into this just like obnoxiously cocky character that just I think actually complements his in-ring style really, really well.
Oh yeah. You know? Yeah. I think I saw someone describe Ricochet's current character as the only time in history that be more like you are on Twitter turned into good career advice because he's known for being kind of an ass on social media. So he's just playing that character in the ring. I hope he's playing a character, but he's doing that right now. And it just is firing on all cylinders. This match, Ace Austin does like there are a lot of similarities to Ricochet when he was younger, and that he's got all these incredible moves. These guys obviously they gelled very well. I didn't think there was any question that was going to happen. Austin now has had two title shots, lost both of them, and does not feel diminished by that, which is an accomplishment. Like, he had a great match against Kyle Fletcher a few weeks ago, and now against Ricochet. Like, this is, I guess, because he's still so new, you don't expect him to be winning anything. So just being able to have this caliber of match is doing him a lot of favors. Of course, after the match is over, who shows up but FTR coming to beat down the Bang Bang Gang's other member. Bang Bang Gang, as you would expect, come out to the rescue. Brawl ensues, punches from Juice and Austin to take down the champs, who just bail and leave their belts in the ring. And so Austin Gunn did a great bit here where he's almost like sort of hesitating to pick up, like, and the crowd's like, touch it. And he and Juice do grab the belts. Austin lifts his up. Juice just immediately like yeets the belt at Cash Wheeler. Austin sort of does a little bit of a victory lap before tossing the other belt to
because the whole promo
the
prior
FTR
was
as well.
The whole promo prior was FTR kind of like taunting them to touch their belt
yeah.
You know.
So this was a nice circle back moment. We then go to tonight's main event, which is Jonathan Moxley versus Konosuke Takeshita. Mox here gets a mostly babyface reaction. Last night, at one point, before he left the commentary desk on Final Battle, he actually stood up and cut a promo sort of talking shit about not so much Takeshita as the Don Callis family. And let me tell you, this was a 100% babyface promo that he did last night. Like, this was just, he talked about being raised on Ohio tap water and how that had made him strong. Don't know what's in the taps in Ohio. I suspect it's like, well, it produces John Moxley. This was like, he came out and he's not altering the character, but yeah, this, he's very much, he's received obviously his home state, he's like he is received more as a baby face, but you can tell that the turn is coming, or you know, is kind of happening on its own, like organically. Like, they're not even having to do like one big move. Now, Takeshita comes out, he also gets a big baby face reaction, which is hilarious since these guys are sort of the kingpins of the two biggest heel stables, both being treated as baby faces because they are sort of straying from the roles that they were in before. The crowd starts chanting, holy shit, and as well as both these guys. Mostly sort of mat-based exchange to start. The first big takedown happens when Takeshita hits the Takeshita line. Mox is favoring his ankle, which Takeshita notices and targets. And the story there being that, of course, those ankles were damaged in his matches with Kyle O'Reilly. I noticed that commentary even sort of floats the idea that it wasn't a factor in the match with Claudio because Claudio was choosing not to target it, like as a sign of respect. Takeshita, no respect. He is absolutely interested in targeting that ankle. He wraps it around the post, smashes it into the stairs. He puts Moxley on a chair and slams the ankle into the guardrail. Moxley gets back into the ring, but just collapses, like unable to move. Takeshita, like he smells blood, which in a John Moxley match would not be an odd thing, although not here. He hits a dragon screw on the ankle. He's stomping on it. Mox suplexes Takeshita over the ropes, hits a drop kick and this massive curb stomp onto the apron, which sends Takeshita, he's rolling to the floor. It's actually like drooling when you look at him. Like, nice effect. Like, a little bit gross, but sort of it definitely sold this as being just deadly. Mox hits a pair of suplexes back in the ring, and both men hit clotheslines that kind of cancel each other out. They go to a forearm battle and just both are exhausted from the effort. Mox is a running lariat, but can't capitalize. It's a blue thunder bomb attempt by Takeshita that is blocked and turned into a headlock takeover by Moxley, who then applies an ankle lock of his own and forces Takeshita to the ropes. Mox stomps on Takeshita's ankle himself, just for good measure, to make sure that it really hurts. He attempts a pile driver, which is then turned into a back body drop on the apron by Takeshita. Takeshita goes to run the ropes, but he collapses. He tries again, and this time hits a Topikon Hilo, and both men are down on the outside. Takeshita gets up, and I'm assuming intended to hit a move on the commentary desk, but yeah. He just sort of moves one thing and the entire desk collapses. So he's just kind of looking like, well, shit. I just casually destroyed this desk. So whatever. He grabs Moxley, hits the Raging Fire onto the remains of the desk and goes back into the ring.
I thought that made it better, Kate. The cushion is not there, but I'm going to like throw this man onto the pile of rubble anyway. And yeah, there was still enough table for it to make a sound, but it almost felt
And it was sort of like you had a couple of bits that were just sort of propped up. Like Moxley arguably hit
the worst
more
part.
Hard edges.
Yeah.
Like because the desk fell apart beforehand. Yeah. Like this is one of those things where it's clearly a mistake, but you're right, it almost made it better because it's just brutal when he landed. Bryce Remsburg is administering the count, and Moxley comes in at like 9.87. I will say he just barely manages to get under the ropes before the 10 count, and Takeshita immediately hits him with a crossbody for a 2 count. He sets up for the knee strike, but Moxley just collapses. He does a Jay White, shall we say, who I think made this favorite, where it's just like, you can't hit me with your move because I am not not strong enough to sit up and take it. As Takeshita approaches him, though, Mox almost manages to roll him over for the pin. He takes him down with a cutter. Takeshita traps Mox's ankle between his knees and just drops that look tremendously painful. That Mox makes it back to his feet. It's a big forearm and a DDT for two before Takeshita just barely gets his leg onto the rope to break the count. Running clotheslines for both men and Mox hits a massive boot to Takeshita's face. Mox then just collapses. Takeshita hits the knee, but Moxley kicks out. Takeshita recovers. It's a knee strike, a Raging Fire. Kenosuke Takeshita pins John Moxley in his home state to move to 6 points and tie Claudio Castagnoli at the top of the league, but with a match in hand.
This match, I thought, was every bit a pay-per-view worthy match. It was every bit a G1 worthy match. This was my favorite match of the Continental Classic thus far. I felt for this one really interesting because of the storytelling. I mean, you had Mox selling the ankle, which in and of itself I think is a great way to show the repercussions of the Kyle O'Reilly feud, and as a way to keep Kyle's presence in this tournament despite his inclusion in it. I mean, you know, he's not here, but like we are still reminded of the effects of what he did to this guy. Giving John Moxley a body part to sell, I mean, I think clearly spells to us that like Wednesday's babyface performance was not just meant to be a one-off. That coupled with the promo last night, I mean, we seem to be fully committing.
And the backstage bit that they did with the Death Riders was almost kind of sad. I don't know if you saw it where he's talking
about
like
push-ups?
Him sort of saying to Claudio, like, if you win, we win, or if Pac wins, we win. But seeming so unsure of himself.
Sure.
Yeah.
Like, this man is clearly, on one level, maybe we're happy that he's getting his comeuppance. But on another level, we're just like, we kind of admire how little he's willing to just like give up, and maybe ultimately like on a meta level, we're just respecting the hell out of this guy's performances, right?
Yeah.
So he like, at least from the storytelling, it feels very obvious to me that we're fully committing to a Jon Moxley babyface turn in the middle of this tournament, which might be one of this tournament's lasting legacies, the Jon Moxley babyface turn. I find it especially interesting considering he's doing it all in this case against Konosuke Takeshita, who himself is going through a babyface transition opposite Okada,
this is something where the dynamic of both men, it is weird, but the weirdness didn't translate to the way it does. Yeah, exactly. Like, it should be more kind of unsettling. Awkward. Makes it sound weird, but yeah, it should be more awkward than it is, but it absolutely isn't. Great credit to the crowd here. Like, they kind of see what's up. They were going to cheer for their home guy, but they don't hate Takeshita. They know where this is going. These guys taken out of context are baby faces. It's just sort of what they have anchored to them from their past that is keeping them heels in other situations. You didn't have that. You didn't have any members of the Don Callis family. You did not. The Death Riders sort of came out at the very end, just as the feed cut. You didn't see anything, but they were not, obviously, like, with the rules in this in this competition, you don't have people coming out to support or interfere or anything, but that means that you're seeing these guys completely separately from their factions. And when you see them away from their factions, they are baby faces already. Mm-hmm. So
true. I think what makes Takeshita actually like a very suitable person for this type of storytelling is the fact that like he plays a very convincing, you know, favorite for Jon Moxley to play an underdog against. He's just like so good, so dominant, so credible that you could buy Jon Moxley like fighting from underneath against somebody like Takeshita, the way you could under Claudio Castagnoli, for instance. So I like all of that like was incredibly, I think, interesting to me. The fact that this came across so well, the storytelling hit so well, despite maybe the awkwardness of like what it looked like on paper. I found it really interesting that Moxley was started to do the ankle lock himself, you know, like psychologically, what do you think like he's trying to have that represent? You know, the announcer suggested that it's his way of exercising his demons, which I find to be a really interesting concept. Like a form of like facing your trauma head on to basically like kind of like what better understand and come to grips with this embarrassment that you've suffered on your Kyle O'Reilly. Very interesting concept that he introduced here.
Or that you're kind of absorb everything that you've gone through, your losses and your wins, and you sort of use that to get better and stronger, or to try to fashion wins. I think the thing with Moxley is he's just at the stage where it's like people have figured out how to beat him, and he's trying to incorporate these other things that have been used to beat him to see if he can turn that around, like to see if he can turn that into a win, but it's just not clicking. Like, look, he's going to do just fine in this tournament. He's going to have a good run, but you see with these early losses where like, it's not like the losses to O'Reilly where it's like the confidence is gone. And so you've got him trying to sort of figure out how to turn this around and maybe not really knowing.
Taking the technique of the person who beat you, essentially trying to learn from the person who beat you, actually represents like a very egoless sort of like growth, does it not? You know?
Yeah.
Like all I'm asking is that the type of storytelling that Jon Moxley is intentionally trying to convey with his character going for the ankle lock, for instance? Or is this just something that we're maybe reading too much into?
I think if we see, like, it's not as if we've never seen him do an ankle lock before, but this was, it's having done the matches with O'Reilly and having had it been such a clear, like, with it being such a clear story there. Like, it's
literally
like
his Achilles
heel. Yeah. So it's played such a role in this kind of the beginning of the downfall of Jon Moxley. And if for commentary to mention it, like if we're reading too much into it, well, so are they. So it would strike. Right. It would be odd to me if they if we were all sort of seeing something and it wasn't really there. So yeah, I'm going to go with this is intentional.
Yeah, yeah, a great, great match. Like my favorite of the tournament so far.
Yeah.
Do you sort of have any favorites at this point in the tournament? Because this is only like a 6-match per person tournament proper in the round robin.
And we're already 3-match. Like what? Well, some of them we've gotten a little off. Like some people are on 3, some people are on 2. It's like some. Right. So it's a little difficult to tell. I do think. I would not be entirely surprised to see Mox versus Pac as the final. But
certainly.
Like, I mean, I think a lot of people went into this thinking it was going to be Okada Takeshita. The clownery with the, which title is on the line and which title and who has legs and whatever else you're going to go on, makes me think that they're trying to find a way to have Takeshita and Okada fight for a belt without it being the finale of the Continental Classic. We shall see. Right. So yeah, that's where I am. Maybe, I feel like the Mox story has kind of taken over in terms of momentum from Okada Takeshita.
For me, it's taken over this entire company over the past, like, you know, like 3 months, say 2 months. I've been so interested. And for me, like these sort of performances tonight make me continue to reassess where John Moxley ranks in my sort of like, you know, year-end awards. Cause you know, Bandido and Takeshita are rightfully being discussed as like the best in-ring performers, but as like the complete performer with like the promos and the storytelling, Moxley like is, you could make a case is, you know.
Well, I think right also because if you're talking about like for 2025, the sort of the drudgery of the Death Riders raid and that ended last year. Like the stuff that's been going on this year was considerably like it was sort of getting more and more intense and getting better until he drops the title. And then you've continued to have this really interesting evolution since then. He's arguably been more interesting since he's dropped the title. Yeah. So yeah, I think you're right. I can certainly see that. I guess with Moxley, what you haven't had as much, and this is partly because of the role the Death Riders have been playing, is you haven't had the matches at the quality that Bandido and Takeshita have had, generally speaking. But it's not like he hasn't had some really good matches. And this was a reminder of how good his in-ring can be. Like, this is just such a such a solid matchup. So, yeah, I thought really, like, well, I guess like we have a perfect sort of back-to-back comparison since we were here last week. I thought this was just far superior show to last week. Like last week had some good Continental Classic matches, but this was just, this show had a lot of hits on it.
Very strong show. Like, you know, well-rounded in terms of great in-ring content that I don't think was just happening for the sake of happening. Like I thought every match had some purpose to it. And great promos to really break up the action. So it really felt like a good, complete show that also felt very relevant to the overall sort of like storytelling of AEW itself. Had a good amount of star power on this one as well. So totally high marks. And do you want to confirm your opinion that this you like this more than Dynamite?
Yeah, I did. I thought that just there was so much good here. And having the Continental Classic does mean that the stories are going to get woven together much more tightly than they often are. But I think that you're doing a good job. Like Ace Austin, the Bang Bang Gang are becoming, Bang Bang Gang have always been sort of an important part of Collision, but you're seeing that happen again. You got like FTR, although they were on the show on Wednesday, of course, like their work is more focused on Collision. So you still have some Collision oriented stuff, but the stories are sort of getting knit together more tightly because of the Continental Classic. I thought they did a good job of sort of following up some stuff that happened at Ring of Honor last night. So yeah, just very well-crafted show.
To listen to the rest of this podcast, consider becoming a member at postwrestlingcafe.com.
This month at postwrestlingcafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. Postwrestlingcafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.